Pretty hands reached out and they reached wide. Now you may feel it should have been a voluntary cause, but that's not the point, my friends. When the money keeps rolling in.
Hi, this is James Marino. Just a little maintenance regarding last week's show. Our feed seems to have picked up a repeat show, as many of you reported. If you did not hear our Tony Awards wrap-up last week, delete the repeated show in iTunes and then re-download it. You should get the correct show then. And coming up this week, we talk about Love Goes to Press, Storefront Church, Rapture, Blister Burn, The Most Happy Fella, February House, the Tony Awards in Memoriam section, Rock of Ages, the movie, Bunheads 54 Below, and the 50th anniversary of Shakespeare in the Park, all coming up on This Week in Broadway.
Own your landlord's house, take the family on vacation. Ava and her blessed fun can make your dreams come true. Here's all you have to do, my friends. Write your name and your dream on a card or a pad or a ticket. Throw it high in the air and should Our Lady pick it, she will change your way of life for a week or even two. Name me anyone who cares as much as ever.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, June 17th, 2012. My name is James Marino, and in the recording this morning, we have three people with us. Actually, I guess I'm the fourth. So yeah. We normally have three. So with us this morning, we have Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and photographer. You can see his writing and his photography at BroadwayStars.com. You can see his photography at FollowsButPhoto.com. Michael also writes for websites such as Arts America and the Sondheim Review. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
Also with us is Peter Felicia. Peter is a writer. You could read his writing at the New York Star Ledger. He writes for Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays, for Critchaland on Fridays, and in the MTI blog throughout the month. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Good morning. Also with us is a returning guest, Jan Simpson from Broadway and Me. She writes at Broadway and Me, which is BroadwayandMe.com. She's also now the co-director of the Arts and Culture Journalism Program at CUNY for the Graduate School of Journalism, and she occasionally writes for TDF Stages. Her most recent piece was on Peter Dubois, the director of Rapture, Blister, Burn, which just opened at Playwrights Horizons to mainly good reviews. So good morning, Jan.
Good morning. It's nice to be back with you guys.
All right. This morning, we're going to start off by talking about Love Goes to Press, which is up at the Mint, and Jan is going to introduce that. Jan, why don't you take us away?
Love Goes to Press is one of those plays that the Mint does where they find works that have not been done very much or haven't been done for a very long time. And this is a play that's by Martha Gellhorn and Virginia Coles, who were two women foreign correspondents, primarily during the World War II era. At least that's when they were best known. And Martha Gellhorn, much to her dismay, is also best known perhaps as the, I believe, third wife of Ernest Hemingway. And this play is really something that I think Gellhorn and Coles did as a lark. It's about two women foreign correspondents during World War II, as they were, and their professional and romantic entanglements. It takes place in what they call a press camp, where a group of journalists, primarily American journalists, but a Brit as well, are gathered waiting for a battle to begin that they can cover. And in come these two women. They don't arrive together. They come. They've had various liaisons with some of the men who are there. One who's sort of the Ernest Hemingway character is the former husband of one of the women, and another of the women sort of has a flirtation with the British officer, PR officer, who runs the camp. And it's kind of a comedy about the way they use their feminine wiles to get stories and establish contacts. It's It's probably most interesting because it is Martha Gellhorn and because the play so closely tracks the experiences of those two women. I thought it was really, you know, pretty light and inconsequential, but enjoyable enough. I know Peter saw it, so I'm interested in what he thought.
All right, Peter, what did you think about this?
I think I liked it more than that. What was interesting to me, the two ladies, by the way, to make it a little easier to know what we're talking about, one is Annabelle, and she's the one who's been married to the reporter before, and they've had an up-and-down relationship, but she still loves him. The other one is Jane, and Jane is the one who finds herself very much pursued by the gentleman in the press room who really has her future all mapped out for her. And that's what's interesting about the play, to see that way back in the late 40s, when this play opened and closed in a weekend, by the way, that this issue was coming up about career versus love, that this man is just so clueless about the fact that she would want a career. He just feels that he is rescuing her from this terrible fate, that she'll never have to worry about a thing anymore, that he's going to pay the bills, that she can live in where he has lived all his life, and feels that, of course, she will be immediately happy to be relieved of every responsibility she's ever had in her life. And he just doesn't get it, that she enjoys her work and is fascinated by it. What's also interesting about Annabelle's plight is that she's in competition with her former husband. They both are out for the same story, and of course who gets the story first is an issue as well. So that turns out to be a very important component in the play, whether or not they will certainly be able to succeed on a level. So I really love plays where career is pitted versus love, because there are two great needs that we all have in our lives. We want to have successful career. We want to have successful relationship. And, you know, while Comden and Green told us in Make Someone Happy, love is the answer, someone to love is the answer. Yes, it's an answer. Whether or not it's the answer is up to an individual, but there are people for whom career is more important. There are people for whom love is more important. And those are the issues in this play, and I thought it was really quite good. It is fascinating to think that this is a play that collapsed so quickly on Broadway. It was a bigger hit in London, but the women who wrote it fully admitted later they had no idea what they were doing. They just thought, oh, let's write a play. They didn't think much of it. They just, as it came to them. And under those circumstances, it's a terrific rookie effort. And bless the Mint for finding these things. I mean, Jonathan Bank, who runs the Mint, literally sits, he's told me this, literally sits at IBDB. And there's this wonderful feature on IBDB where you can call up a show and there's a little button that says next show that opened, and you can press that. Well, he just goes back into these seasons of yore, and he just looks at every entry and just presses next one, next one, next one, and he finds these things. And it, sure, I mean, there is some cachet here to thinking this was written by Ernest Hemingway's wife, sure. But it does have some value, too, because it reminds us that this was such a struggle, career versus love, for women back then. What's also interesting to me is that people looked so different in the 40s from the way they look now. And the hairstyles on the two ladies really was very, very accurate. And it made them look really like 40s ladies. So I thought that was very skillful as well. Three acts, takes a while, no question, no masterpiece, but I found it of more than moderate interest for bringing up a subject that probably wasn't brought up that much back then, because this was still the era when women were supposed to be very happy at home and were looking for the good provider. So because it got a beat on that, I was able to enjoy going back to the 1946-47 era when the play was first produced and seeing what was on people's minds then. So, pokey, sometimes, sure. Overwritten, sure. But still fascinating to me. I'm glad I went.
I haven't seen this production, but it's interesting. It sounds kind of similar to, in a way, to the theme of Lady in the Dark.
Yeah, that's true.
And sure. That was what, like 1940? Is that right?
41, I think.
Yeah. So. I guess it was in the air, and some people dealt with it anyway, you know. And then, of course, there's the film version of the front page.
Oh, the front page is the perfect one for Career versus Love. There's no question. that's the one that may be the granddaddy of them all.
Yeah.
But the thing about, you know, what was interesting about Lady in the Dark as opposed to Love Goes to Press. Yes, one could say, see, Lady in the Dark got there 6 years earlier. Yeah, that's a very effective argument. But on the other hand, Lady
in
the Dark. I'm sorry?
Look how it ends.
Yes, that's true. But what's so interesting to me is the fact that, after all, there's a profound difference between being editor of a magazine and literally having your life in your hands. And at any given moment, it could all come to an end. I mean, there's a scene where when the couple is the most in love that they will be during the whole play, that's when a bomb comes nearby, the lights shake, and plaster comes down from the ceiling. So one can understand a man's point of view back then, I underline that, of let me take you away from all this, that would be his motivating. I mean, the guy's got his heart is in a very good place, but he just cannot see that it's also an exciting life for a woman. And that's a very interesting issue.
Yeah.
All righty. So let's move forward on to our next production. Peter, I think, did you get a chance to see Storefront Church as well?
No, I did not.
You didn't? Okay. So, Jan and Peter, what did we think about Storefront Church? Peter, why don't you start us off on this one?
This is a disappointing play, I have to say. We all expected it to be wonderful because, after all, the guy who wrote Doubt wrote it. And it's a very hard thing when somebody has written something that's so acclaimed and then a subsequent play doesn't live up to it. But frankly, if anybody wrote this play, I don't think it would be as interesting as the author thought it would be. And so it does deal with religion and whether or not these storefront churches do offer the religion as is conventionally meant. But there's also a good deal about finance in the play as well. To me, the best thing about it was Zach Renee, a very good actor. And I was so sorry when the lights came up and I saw that he had a stroke. You know, I thought it was really wonderful that they had hired an actor who had a stroke. I thought that was really nice of them to be so loyal to an actor that they would have him do this. Well, no. I'm happy to say Zach has not had a stroke.
My God.
Boy, is he I'm giving you the experience I had, because this is what I believed while I was seeing it. You know, and because what he does with his mouth, it really seems as if there's no way that he could possibly be doing this unless he had a stroke. And he turns out to be a far more important character than it would seem he would be, because he is somebody who has never been brought to church in his life. His parents just weren't into religion. He knows nothing about it. He is totally ignorant. It has escaped him. And that's an interesting character. You know, somebody who doesn't know even how to say grace at the table. And as a result, he turns out to be the one that is most influenced by what goes on in this storefront church. And the question is somebody who's never found religion more susceptible to religion? Is somebody more open to religion? You know, which is the word, open or susceptible? A lot of us have issues with religion, Lord knows. But nevertheless, seeing it from a fresh point of view, from an adult point of view. I was talking to somebody the other day who told me that he was a staunch Catholic, believed everything, every bit of it. That's it. I said, well, what would have happened if your parents were Jewish? He said, well, I believe everything.
I always ask that question, Peter.
Yeah, and he had no problem whatsoever saying, oh, I believe everything that the Jewish faith was telling, because that's what my parents believed. You know, and we're all different people, Lord knows, and we all have our values. And that's surprised me. you know, one would like to think that one's religion is something that one chooses and relates to, as opposed to being handed down like a Queen Anne chair. So the issues of religion were really something to ponder here, and that's the value of the play. But I did find it tough going.
I liked the play less than Peter did because I left after the first act, and that's not something that I do. But I want to dial back a little bit and just sort of give a little bit more of the plot. This takes place in the South Bronx. The Bronx is where playwright John Patrick Shanley grew up, and it pivots around this church that is in the basement of, I guess, sort of a brownstone building that's owned by this retired couple. The wife is Hispanic, her husband is Jewish, they are longtime residents of the area, and this minister comes into the neighborhood. He is from New Orleans, and it is post-Katrina, and that's relevant. And he wants to start a church, and the wife wants to help him, and not only rents him their basement to start the church, but gives him some money to help develop the church. She takes out a mortgage, a second mortgage on the house. And because the minister is having a crisis of faith, he really doesn't do anything to develop the church. So no money is coming in, and there's a crisis because now the second mortgage can't be paid off. This woman goes to the son of a friend who, as it so happens, is the borough president of the Bronx, and ask him if he can help her with her bankers. Her husband has gone to the bank. The banker is played by Zach Grenier, as Peter just described. The husband, the banker says there's nothing he can do. The husband has a heart attack in the bank. It's a very convoluted plot. And then the borough president goes to the bank and tries to work out a deal, and then goes to the minister, to the church, and has this long dialogue with the minister, which is the closing scene of the first act, and it is deadly. The whole thing just screeches to a halt there, where these two basically just espouse the philosophy that Shanley seems to have about religion. For me, there was no plot, no dynamism. Some of the actors were very good. Not only was Zach Grenier really good, and Peter's right, I thought he had a stroke too. And I thought, this is uncomfortable. So he was really very good in doing that. But Bob Dishy is very good and very funny as the husband. Tanya Pinkins plays the wife of Giancarlo Esposito, is the borough president. There are some very good people in this play, but part of the problem is that it is directed by the playwright, John Patrick Shanley, and he needed another eye. He needed somebody else there to say, you know, maybe this is not working, you know, maybe you need a little more going on here. But I can't speak to the second act because I left.
It brings up a good point about walking out. Does anybody here remember the first show of which he or she walked out? It's a question I like to ask people.
No.
I think mine may have been The Best Little Whorehouse Goes Public.
Aha. I can understand that, but I didn't get it.
A friend and I went, and afterwards we just kind of walked out, and we actually walked outside and sat on the curb with our heads in our hands. Yeah,
you know, I wonder, this is an interesting statistic, I wonder if going to the theater alone or going with someone else enhances the possibility that you'll stay or leave, because I have a feeling that that when I've gone with people who have, I'm not talking about when I was reviewing, but I would be I would certainly, with my former wife, she would certainly have very little patience with things that she didn't like. And we walked out quite a bit because, after all, you know, one car driving home, you know, what could we do, you know? So, but I wonder if we're more inclined to leave them with somebody else than if we were alone, where we don't have to bear the brunt of the responsibility of, oh, I'm putting this person through this.
You know, well, so. I was alone on this one. Uh-huh. And I felt I didn't want to put myself through it.
I remember there was a musical in Boston called Comedy, which was a Commedia dell'arte musical. This is in 1972. And my wife thought it was just dreadful. And we left. And I wanted to see the second act. So I went back and I second acted. And I couldn't take it either. I left before the second act was over. So it's a show I walked out of twice in a strange sort of way. It closed on the road, by the way, and that was that. But walking out, it's something that I don't think we do very lightly. No, I don't think we want to do that.
No, of course not. And as Peter says, when you're reviewing, you know, you know, unless you really, unless it's a very extraordinary situation, I think you want to stay. But when you're not reviewing, I always experience, it's an interesting point, Peter. There's a moment where you kind of look at the person you're with, and like one person is waiting for the other one to just kind of say, well, do you want to stay?
All right. Now, this brings up another good point, Michael. Do you regret having left Torhouse Goes Public?
In retrospect, yes, because especially, was it you or someone who told me that there was at least one really interesting number in the second act?
Yes, there was.
and often I am one to persuade other people not to leave for you know, if only for historical purposes, because, you know, you just never know. Well, I mean, you never know what is going to be in the second act, but also, you know, if it is something that turns out to be an epic flop, or even that turns out to be a hit, you don't want to. You don't want to say, you know, I only saw half of it. But
I agree. I mean, I in retrospect regret every show I've walked out of. And certainly. The type of thing you're talking about. I remember The Prince of Central Park was one I walked out of, and people said, oh, then you missed that second act number. Oh my God, you wouldn't have believed it. Oh my God. You know, so
that's
I'm sorry.
So funny that you mentioned that one, because I remember specifically a friend of mine saying he went to that, and there were some guys who were going to leave at intermission. And my friend said, are you crazy? You can't leave. You have to see what, you have to stay for the whole thing and see what's going to happen next.
Yeah, are there any clues out there? Like, I look around when I'm walking into a theater to see if perhaps the ushers have a very thick book to read. You know, because I think the thickness of the book is relative to how good the show is, because the ushers have to see it all the time, over and over. And this weekend they have Broadway Bears up at Roseland, and nobody's reading any thick books there. You know,
I don't think so.
Pamphlets are in their hands. Right?
Have you ever been into a situation where you're like, oh my goodness, this is the worst thing I've ever seen in my entire life, and you look to the person, you say, you know, I want to leave, and they're like, what? This is the best show I've ever seen in my life.
Yes. Yes, it happened to be in Maine last year at a Burt Bacharach musical that was called Burt and Me, and it was about a guy who was crazy for Burt Bacharach. And
I wasn't Ernie and Burt.
Nope. And God, the actor playing the me, Burt never appeared. The actor playing the me was so repulsive and thought he was so wonderful. And this time I was with two people who rarely go to the theater, and they were having a hell of a time, you know, so I dutifully slugged it out. But that's what I think I wouldn't have regretted going to. You know, other times too, the ones that you might walk out of are the ones, of course, that you've seen a million times. You know, if it's a bad production of a play you adore.
Right, right.
Right. You know, you certainly know how it's going to turn out, and you know that they just don't have it. So, but again, reviewing is a different thing. Last night I was at Once Upon a Mattress in Princeton. There's something there called the Princeton Festival, which is a great music festival, and they do a million musical things, you know, chamber music and ballet and all these things. And they do one musical a year. And I adore Once Upon a Mattress. I think it's a wonderful show. And the three women in it, who played Winifred and the Queen and Lady Larkin, were terrible, just god awful. But I was reviewing, so I had to stay. But truly atrocious, over the top performances. I really believe that all the guys who have been pumping steroids into athletes got down to Princeton and juiced up these ladies, because I mean, it is so over the top. So so that's painful. But what can you do? You know, I mean, you're reviewing, you have to stay. So yeah, I think John Simon was the one who was castigated for leaving a show once, and he came up with the expression, "Well, you don't have to taste an entire bottle of wine to know whether or not the wine is good."
Well,
I think that's a little simplistic.
That's,
you know,
I'm not going to write about Starfront Church.
Yeah. Please don't take this as a castigation.
No, I don't. And it's also a show that I paid my own money to see.
Wow.
So I felt totally liberated.
Yep.
That it was my dime, and so I could do with it as I please. And had I been invited by the company, by the production, I certainly would have stuck it out. I think there is a difference, and I don't get to play just ordinary audience person very much. So I got to do that with this play.
Well, I tend to try to, in my life, accentuate the positive and focus on the positive. But I think back to last Sunday and that Hairspray number. And if I were on that boat, I'd walk out. You know,
not the gangplank.
Yes,
man overboard.
I mean, I'm a pretty good swimmer. Anyway, next on the agenda is Rapture Blister Burn. Jan saw it, and she also wrote about it for TDF Stages. So, Jan, why don't you give us a quick rundown of Rapture Blister Burn?
Rapture Blister Burn is by Gina Gianfrido, who a few years ago did Becky Shaw, a play that was shortlisted for the Pulitzer. So there's been a lot of interest to see what her next piece would be. And this is a play that also deals with the issue that Peter is very interested in, the push and pull between one's personal life and one's professional life. In this particular play, it's embodied by these two women who were friends at graduate school, and they took two very different paths later in life. One dropped out of graduate school and married one of their fellow students, a man whom they both dated. And she has become a wife and a mother. He finished graduate school and is now the dean of a small college. The other woman finished her degree, went on to teach, write books, and become sort of a public intellectual, one of those people who pops up on Charlie Rose and CNN talking about things. Her specialty is feminism, women's studies. She has a particular interest in pornography and horror films and their portrayal of women. Both of these women are at a point in their lives, however, they're probably in their early to mid 40s, where they're reassessing whether or not the choices they made were the right ones. And the plot sort of kicks off when the mother of the academic has had a heart attack. And so she has traveled home to be with her mother, although her mother seems pretty spry as the play goes on. She's traveled home to be with her mother, and it is in the same town where her old friends are living and the college town there. She decides she's going to stay in this town for a while, take a sabbatical from her job in what we assume is New York City, her main academic job, and she's going to take a visiting professorship at this small college. Over the summer, she decides to hold a little course, and for the convenience of the play, there are only two people who sign up for the course. One is her old friend, and the other is a young woman who has been the babysitter of the friend's children. And during the course of the play, they discuss women's issues, feminism, and as the play evolves, the women, the two primary women, change lives. One takes the academic, rekindles her earlier love affair with the husband of her old friend, and the wife in that couple moves to New York, moves into the apartment of the academic to see how she might be on her own. And then we get a sense of whether or not they truly have led the wrong lives. The fun of the play for me, and I think it's really well done, the fun of it is looking at feminism from three different generations. The mother who had the heart attack, who lived a more conventional kind of life. The two women who were born during who came to fore during the 70s and 80s, are beneficiaries of the women's movement in the 60s and 70s. And then this young woman who is, I guess we call post-feminist. And they reach some interesting and not predictable conclusions. Gina Gianfrido has said that she was not thinking about Wendy Wasserstein's The Heidi Chronicles. But in a sense, this is really kind of a conversation with that play. Although I have to say, I like the way this ends better than the way Heidi did. I think it's a really, really terrific production. And I'm curious if either of you guys have seen it and what you think.
I haven't been.
No, me neither.
Oh, it's worth it.
It's
worth it, and a really top-notch cast.
All right. So Jan also wrote about this for TDF Stages, and I've linked to it in the show notes. So if you want to see it, head over to broadwayradio.com, and there's a section where you can click on it and find her story. It's good to make a writer squeamish. You don't get to use squeamish very much in, in headlines, but... that's good. You know, if it's not Friday the 13th movies and things like that.
Well, the hairspray.
The hairspray made me squeamish. Or I was, what do they use? Dramamine for motion sickness? Or
yes.
Things like that. So, all right. Michael got a chance to see Frank Lesher's The Most Happy Fella at Michael Help Me with DiCapo.
DiCapo Opera Theater.
DiCapo Opera Theater. And so we talked about this a few weeks ago before it was coming up. Michael got a chance to see it. Michael, what's the verdict?
Oh, my God. It is fantastic.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Excellent. I mean, they have a 29-piece orchestra on stage at the rear of the stage.
All right. Everybody stop the podcast right now. Go order tickets. 29-piece orchestra. You can see that on Broadway.
I know.
Exactly.
Great.
And I mean, don't go expecting sets because you won't get any. But other than that, the orchestra's at the rear of the stage, and you know, I mean, it's fully staged in terms of the blocking. There's not a lot of choreography, but there is some.
Sounds sort of encore style.
Yeah, pretty much. But the amazing thing is, DiCapo performs in a very intimate theater at 76th and Lexington, and it's actually their own theater that was built in the basement level of a church, St. John Baptiste. And it's a unique theater. The stage is I would say pretty much almost as wide as a Broadway stage, but it's not very high. There are only 200 seats. So the equation is very different, but also the most amazing thing about it is, and they normally do operas, and there is a pit. There is a pit in the theater, but they, for whatever reason, they decided not to use it for this one. And I actually interviewed Michael Capasso, who directed the show and who also runs Da Capo. And I said, well, before I saw it, I said, well, isn't it difficult, especially with the orchestra on stage, for the singers to be heard without amplification? And he said, no, he said, we're just acoustically blessed with the theater. And he was right. There wasn't a moment when the orchestra covered any of the singers. And they all are performing completely, absolutely, totally without amplification. And of course, the orchestra itself is also unamplified. So you get the kind of a pure sound that you just... Really, there are very, very few places where you can hear musical theater done that way. You can still go to the Met and hear an opera done that way. But even encores. That's always been one of my issues with encores. I wonder if they ever tried to do them. No, I mean, I know they didn't try. I wonder if they ever considered trying performing the encore shows without amplification. New York City Opera used to perform there years ago and actually will be returning at least sometimes for some of their shows. And they presumably perform without amplification. So presumably that theater is acoustically sound, but I think they just people expect too much today. We have become too used to body mics and being able to understand every single word, and so I don't think Encore's probably ever considered that. But this Happy Fella, really, I mean, it runs. They did it a couple of months ago, and for only four performances, and it got such rave reviews, including an absolute rave in the Times from Anthony Tomasini, that they brought it back. And this time it's running for 3 weeks. The first week is done now, but it has two more. James, maybe we can post a link to buy tickets, because I'm sorry to say, as often happens in a case like this with a return, and also because the company, it's a wonderful little company, but they don't have a lot of money for advertising. So I went to the opening night of the return engagement, and it was only 2/3 full. But the tickets start at the full price tickets start at $35. And as I said, it only seats 200. So how bad a seat can you possibly get? So I would urge everyone not to miss this. The cast is amazing. They all have opera level voices, but they also act, their acting is terrific. An interesting thing, the guy who plays Tony, his name is Michael Corvino, and I think he does every show except I overheard that he doesn't do the Wednesday evenings because it's a very difficult role. He doesn't play him quite as the jolly, really, really happy character that we normally see, and in a way I miss that, but in another way it made the character less of a cartoon, which it can become, because first of all he has this very thick Italian accent, and if he's also this guy who's kind of jumping around all the time and just being happy, it can seem a little reductive and a little stereotype. But he played him as a much more, much more mature man who knew what he wanted, and it was interesting because it really worked on its own in its own way. Rosabella, you're not going to know any of these people's names. Her name is Molly Molly Mustonen, or Mustonen, Mustonen, beautiful young blonde girl, as she has to be for the really for the role, and you know, gorgeous voice. Herman is Brance Cornelius, delightful. And the girl, the woman who plays Cleo, her name is Lauren Hofmeyer. And my friend and I both said, I went with Kevin McInerney, Peter, and he was just entranced. He said she has one of the best belt voices we've ever heard in our lives, because it's a very powerful sound, but it's not like a raw belt. Somehow it's a belt voice that sort of moves naturally. It sounds like it's also part of her soprano register from the few times when she has to go into that. There's not a big break in her voice. There's not a big hole in her voice. It's a wonderfully equalized sound throughout its range, and it's really beautiful. Conductor Pacien Mazzagatti. You're not going to know any of these people's names, but I'm telling you, after you see this show, I think you will go back many times to DiCapo Opera. Michael told me that he's trying to do more musicals, and they already have scheduled Kismet for next season, as their closer next season, a year from now. So really, I can't, you know, you don't want to overuse the phrase "don't miss it," because you don't want it to lose its value. This time, I really will say, do not miss it. It's unbelievable. It's just incredible.
Wow, that's pretty interesting. Also, prorated, that there can't be any place in the world where you get so many musicians per audience member, because really, essentially, there's a musician for every 7 audience members. And I mean, that doesn't happen, you know.
And so, again, $35 is the cheapest ticket, and I'm not sure, but I don't think it goes much higher than that, because as I said, it is only 200. See, someone was talking at intermission. We were talking with there were some people from the someone from the Frank Lesser estate, and he was thrilled. And then someone who is an associate or friend of Joe Sullivan Lesser, she couldn't make it that night, but they said she's definitely coming. And one of the guys said to Michael Capasso, they said, how do you I think the phrase he used was, how do you turn a buck? In other words, how do you pay for it? How do you even make a profit or even pay for it? And he basically said, we don't. you know, they're nonprofit. And then Michael said something very funny. He said, we are nonprofit in the truest sense of the term. So it's not economically feasible to have that many musicians and that many singers in a Broadway situation, or at least, and certainly not, you know, unamplified. So it's just an incredibly rare and special event. So,
what's interesting to me, and here I go mentioning my book on Tony Losers that I'm writing at the moment, The Most Happy Fella had the misfortune to open 51 days after My Fair Lady. And as a result, in the Tony race, it did not do well, not when My Fair Lady's running. So it's really so sad, because in other seasons, it would have really wiped the floor with much of the competition. But here's what's interesting to me. Goddard Lieberson, when the time came to record the original cast album, decided to record all of it. Maybe a few words left here or there, but I'm talking about dialogue as well as songs. And that's interesting to me. Now, somebody might say, well, you know, there was so much music in the show. There's about 30 songs. It wouldn't fit on one record. Yeah, but it would have fit on two. And yet, why the decision to make this the album where you had dialogue as well as the songs? And it certainly shows that Goddard Lieberson had great respect for what Frank Lesser had achieved.
Yeah.
Frank Lesser had 2 shows on Broadway within 2 years of each other. It took him 6 years to do The Most Happy Fella, because he was doing the book as well. Granted, it was adapted from a Pulitzer Prize-winning play by Sidney Howard, but still, if you've ever seen the play, and I did back in the 70s when I think the Phoenix Theater did it, boy, it's very wordy and very political, and he really cut all that stuff out to good effect. So, So really, it's quite an achievement. While today, getting 6 years to get a musical on might even be speedy, in those days it wasn't. And as a result, the fact that he took 6 years to do a show, he never took that long again, you know, to do a show. And it really, the effort was certainly worth it, because this really is one of musical theater's great masterpieces. And I'm delighted to hear it's being done so well over at DaCapo.
Oh yeah, it's amazing. And yeah, we had discussed the show. Yeah, I guess the show had bad luck. There was, first of all, the opening in The Shadow of My Fair Lady, as Peter mm-hmm. mentioned. It did get a big pluck on a big plug on I Love Lucy, mm-hmm. As we've also discussed. But I was thinking about that recently, and it's interesting. It's almost parenthetical. I mean, they keep talking about the show and they keep mentioning it, and you do hear a little bit of, I believe, Standing on the Corner, at least. Isn't that
right?
You're
talking about the Lucy show?
Yeah, you hear it. You
yeah, I think you hear Joey, too. However, that show was broadcast very late into the run.
Oh, okay.
I have heard, I don't know this for a fact, I have heard that the Arnezes were investors in The Most mm. Happy Fella. And as a result, that's one of the reasons they did that show.
Oh.
That doesn't make it true. I'm only saying that I've heard that.
Well, anyway, so, my point was that you don't actually see any of it. So it certainly gave it publicity. It's not as if people were watching a number on the Ed Sullivan Show, which, I mean, that probably happened too.
No, you actually hear the original cast album, however. I mean, the
right.
cuts here from the album.
Right.
And what's interesting, of course, is that the problem in the show is that Lucy bought the wrong tickets, and so they're able to get two tickets, not four, because Fred and Ethel have come too. And as a result, they decide with only two tickets, the women will see the first act and the men will see the second act. Well, the women are so in love with the first act, they have to see the second act. So actually, something I mentioned earlier, second acting, was actually shown on national TV. I mean, Lucy and Ethel, second act, the show. And that turns out to be a complication as well. One of my favorite moments of the show is that when the ladies go in, Ricky says to Fred, "Gee, I wonder what it's about."
Oh, right.
It's the way husbands do about musicals. And Fred said, "Well, I can tell you the guy's not married." How? Because look at the title, The Most Happy Fella. And so it's really wonderful when the guys try to catch up on what happened in the first act. And Lucy says, "Well, you know, he's not married." And Fred said, "See, I told you." You know what I mean? So what's also interesting to me is that when you look at when they show the three sheet of the show, you do see that the quotation they're using, which I think was The Most Happy Smash, is from Walter Winchell. Now, believe me, they got great reviews. I'm looking at some excerpts right now. "A timeless musical," said the Mirror. "A great, great musical," said the Journal American. "As distinguished as it is delightful," said the News. "Charming and powerful," said the Word Telegraph and Sun. "Lesser has opened his treasure chest and hurled his bountiful prizes." Doesn't that sound like Walter Kerr? It was. "Musical magnificence," said Atkinson of the Time. But isn't it interesting that on the three sheet, "A Most Happy Smash," Walter Winchell, it really shows you how powerful Walter Winchell was still in those days.
All right. So Michael also wrote a story about Most Happy Fella on Broadway Stars, and I'll link to it in the show notes as well. The Happy, Happy Man is the title of it. And
that means you, Michael?
I think I'm gonna pay to go back. That's the ultimate. That is the ultimate.
Them's fighting words.
All righty. So everybody grab your tickets and go see Michael. Say hello.
Right.
He'll be there every night like a rent head in the first row.
I would love to.
He's going to sit in every one of the 200 seats. I can see it now. He'll live tweet from the show. All right. So Michael and Jan got a chance to see February House down at the Public. Peter, you didn't see February House, did you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
You did? So we have a triple play here. Okay, all three of us, let's talk about February House. Let's start it off with Peter then.
This is a musical that is about a group of bohemians, many of whom, all of whom, I guess, were real-life people. And so it does have a lot of potential when you think about it, because the idea of personalities who are bigger than life, real people now understand, is really something, because obviously there are going to be conflicts, aren't there? Because certainly all the writers, all the people who are going to be there, such as W.H. Auden, Carson McCullers, Benjamin Britten, and strangely enough, Gypsy Rose Lee. To think of these people cohabitating together, you really expect fireworks to result. There are very few fireworks, and they don't rise very high in the air. So I was a little disappointed that there wasn't more friction, more conflict in the show. It was almost like a day in the life of any boarding house. All right, yes, the people were more erudite than you would find in, I guess, the average boarding house, because after all, they are people like W.H. Auden and Carson McCullers, etc. In fact, Benjamin Britten was seen to be a little on the silly side. But the music is quite haunting. It's new style theater music. We're not interested in conventional songs, and it has more of that background music feel to which people sing, and so it's an amiable show. But still, it's I would think it's almost impossible for anybody to hear that these people are involved with it. I'm talking about the characters now, and not think that more is going to happen. But Gabriel Kahane, or Kahane, however it's pronounced, really did write some pretty lovely music, and I think it might make a haunting, atmospheric cast album, which I understand is going to happen. They are going to record it. So, but wow, you know, the first item of any drama is really conflict, and I didn't get enough of it.
All right. Jan, what did you think?
I'm with Peter. I really didn't care for this show. And maybe I'm further away from it than Peter is. I was very excited about this show. It is based on a real life incident in which these people and some others live there. Paul Bowles lived there. I think Ralph Ellison lived there for a bit. A whole bunch of people were brought together in this boarding house in Brooklyn by this man named George Davis, who was a fiction editor for a magazine and really got around and knew lots of people. And he brought all of these people who were friends of his, not necessarily all knowing one another, but brought them all together to live communally in this house. And they called the house February House because so many, I think it was Aeneas Nin who named it February House because so many of the residents were born in February. And Kahane came up with sort of the interesting conceit that he was going to assign musical themes that sort of represented each of the characters. And so the styles of music are just slightly different. There's sort of show tune-y stuff for Gypsy Rose Lee and more art song for Auden, sort of an Americana sound, I think, for Carson McCullers. But again, he doesn't do anything with them. They're all just sort of there, and in there's no focus to the show either. We just get presented with these people, and then these people, and then these people, and they have a meal together, they have a party together, but there's no real conflict or real focus. And I found this show a real disappointment.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
You know, this is one of those cases where I understand what both of you are saying, but I really disagree. I was completely captivated by it, and it held my interest throughout. I guess I thought maybe there was a point in Act Two when it started to get a little tedious, and there could have been some cutting there. But for the most part, no, I don't know. I guess I was so interested in the characters and the way they related to each other. I mean, it's true that there's no fireworks between the various characters, but there are some really interesting things that happen within the couples. First of all, Benjamin Britten and Peter Pears. It was so interesting to me when I read about this show to go see a depiction of them on stage, because I don't know how much our listeners know about Benjamin Britten and Peter Pears, but basically Benjamin Britten was a very famous opera composer, British opera composer, who wrote a lot of music that I absolutely cannot stand because it's kind of actively ugly, I think is the word. I mean, it's not melodic in any way that I have ever been able to relate to. But regardless, he was extremely famous, and he wrote continually roles for his lover, the tenor Peter Pears, and including such famous roles as the role of Captain Veer in Billy Budd, the opera Billy Budd, but also many others. So it was interesting for me to see them on stage. But also, I confess, I really did not know a lot about W.H. Auden and his male lover, Chester Kallman. And there's a point in the show, I guess I can give a spoiler now because it's closing
today.
Today. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Jen. Where Auden tries to kill Kallman on stage because he's out of jealousy. And we spoke actually with AJ Shively, who plays Kallman afterwards because he's a friend of a friend of mine. And I said, did that actually happen? And he said, yes, it did. Mm-hmm. It's all documented. So, I don't think it's fair to say that there weren't fireworks. It's just maybe not... maybe not what you expected in terms of Gypsy Rose Lee relating to Benjamin Britten or whatever. And I loved the music also, Peter. I think it's to me it was reminiscent of Michael John Lacuse's work and maybe also Adam Gettle, in the sense that it does use minimalist tactics, like there's repetition and rhythmic repetition, but it also can be extremely melodic. And I love that. There's a song that Auden sings and it's reprised twice, I think, about Kallman called Awkward Angel.
Is that not taken from an Auden poem?
I think I heard that. That would certainly, at least the title is taken, at least the title. And that was a wonderful moment. But I don't want to imply that it's all about Auden and Kallman. I thought all of the characters were handled very well. Gypsy Rose Lee, maybe not so much. And I did say to someone, I think they missed a wonderful opportunity in the show. Wouldn't it have been wonderful if she got a phone call from her mother? And, it would have been too much to certainly bring her mother on stage, to bring Rose on stage. That would have been, I think, annoying. But to have just a little moment where she gets a phone call from her and just, realizing that on the other end of the phone is one of the most famous characters in musical theater history. I think that would have been a nice homage and also just, a really nice touch. So I'm sorry they missed that.
Really all it had to be is mother, and then she hangs up.
That exactly. Exactly. Wouldn't that have been I wonder if they thought of that.
If they did it, we probably would have thought it was cheesy as hell.
Oh, but even just to do that, I don't know. I mean, because her mother, her mother existed.
Yeah, I see the point.
And this is about all these real life people, and I'm sure that she was still in contact with her, even if she's...
Yeah, no. Your point is well taken, but I have a feeling Jan understands what I'm saying.
Yes.
I think the other thing that disappointed me about this is that there was the potential for some really interesting stuff to get into. There are, I guess, three gay couples in the household. And at the beginning of the play, when Britten and Pears come in, and there is another play that's actually written about them, The Habit of Art, which was done at the National Theatre in London 2 years ago, and there was an NT Live broadcast here that's also interesting. But There are three gay couples in the household. And when Britton and Piers first come in, what's wonderful for them is that there's no need for, to camouflage their relationship in this household. This is a haven. This is during a period where gay people still had to be covert in the general public about their lives and their relationships. And here they can be open. And I thought that should have been something that was wonderfully explored. On the other hand, and there are several people who are expatriates from Europe at a time when Europe is in great turmoil. This play is set roughly just before, I think, America's entry into World War II. And these people are conflicted about what's going on in their homelands. Should they be there? Should they be here creating art that's important and that might reflect and inform about the turmoil there? And there just were some wonderful opportunities that just were not explored.
Well, see, I thought that was all in there. Isn't that funny?
It was all touched.
Yeah, that's but way not, I it,
but not developed and really given meat on those bones.
Would it be as long as Gats then?
No, I don't know. I just love this idea so much. And I think if he had settled on one idea, one central focus, and had the other characters, but one central story. The story between Carson McCullough and Davis, the guy who is the host, and whose life actually is sort of the saddest of that group. If there had been a focus, if they had been the central characters and the others around them, I sort of felt that he fell in love with this idea and then just wasn't quite sure how to corral it.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I just didn't have that problem. but I think, yeah, maybe there was not. It is true that there was not a central character, unless you think of it as George Davis.
Yeah, I thought of him as the central character.
Yeah.
And that's hard. I mean, it is achievable that the person we know the least turns out to be the central character, because we are interested in those other people who we've heard about for a long time. Certainly, at least one of them has touched our lives in a certain way. I mean, for me, Carson McCullers. I still remember being a 16-year-old boy and seeing the member of the wedding on TV. I remember vividly and suddenly becoming very interested in this woman. So yeah, I mean, but it's very hard when the least famous person is supposed to be the one who's emceeing, so to speak.
But you know what? I'll bet the creators said to themselves, they may have said to themselves, well, who should be our central character?
I understand
that. And we think it should be this person for that specific reason.
I agree. Yeah. I see that entirely. I understand the motivation for that 100%. I really do. Mm. And yet, while I was sitting there, it's hard not to be more interested than the other people. It's just so hard, you know. This is one that has to be appreciated for what it achieves rather than what it didn't achieve. And I'm hoping with repeated listenings, I'll be able to get to the appreciation level that Michael shows.
I do want to mention Kristen C., I believe that's how you pronounce it, who played Carson McCullers. I thought she was wonderful. And James, it turns out she was in Gats. So there you have that.
James?
Oh, I was on mute. Excuse me there.
Uh-huh.
I was talking to nothing again.
Right.
All righty. So let's move forward into our next topic, and we'll start to wrap up here. Last week, those of us who watched the broadcast on CBS of the Tony Awards did not see the In Memoriam section. And those who were at the Tonys were privileged to see a section that memorialized the passings that we've had in the last season. And the Tony Awards put it out on YouTube, and linked to it in the show notes. And it's a couple of minutes long, and it's worth watching, catching up on the people who have passed on that have made an impact on Broadway. And you guys have anything to say about that? Peter?
Well, sure, it should have been there. And it's very sad that it wasn't there. I'm starting to wonder, though, if there's a possibility that more people will see it on YouTube than would have seen it in the broadcast, since the ratings were so low. But at least it's there now and forever, or at least ostensibly so. So I love these. And whenever any award show does it, I'm very interested to be reminded of the people who were so important to us in one way or another, some of whom we've even known personally and have touched us in this way. And I'm surprised and not surprised at the same time that it happened, because I would have loved to have been a fly in the wall, though, on the discussion of we're going to cut the in memoriam. Was there a flurry of protest? Was there a, yeah, I see your point, yeah. Was there even, nobody will miss it, it's fine, nobody will give it a thought. One has to wonder. So I would have liked to have been a fly in the wall. But, yeah, I think it should have been there.
Michael?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
oh, I mean, Jan, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's Broadway giving its final round of applause and appreciation for all the work that these people have done. And the parts that I always like the most, it's not always just the big stars, mm-hmm. the big names that we know. And it's the reason that we have memorial services anyway. It's our final goodbye to these people. And I missed it. I missed it while watching the show. I kept actually waiting, you know, once you get past the first hour, so it's usually in the second or third hour, and I kept waiting for it. So I hope they bring it back.
When you think about it, it's, you know, the more you think about it, it's really appalling that they didn't include it, especially when you think of what they did include. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah, no. You again.
And I wonder, do any of you guys think that the powers that be will ever pay attention to all of the people who are pointing out that the decisions, that what they're trying to do to get bigger ratings is not working, so they might as well just be, you know, more
mm-hmm.
pure,
be a real theatrical ceremony. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm the odd person out here. I'm not a purist. I think I appreciate the fact of they're trying different things and trying to reach out to different kinds of audiences. I think the reason you guys talked about this last week, but I think the reason that the ratings were low just reflected people's unfamiliarity with the shows that were up. Last year, because of the big excitement around the Book of Mormon, and because of the people who were behind the Book of Mormon, the South Park guys, mm-hmm. it brought in an audience. I mean, you know, the Oscars have grappled with this. That's why they went from 5 nominees to 10 nominees. They wanted to get those Batman and those big commercial movies on the slate so that the millions of people who watch those movies would come in. And so I feel the pain. I feel the pain of the people who are trying to put this together. And I don't think, unless we say, okay, we just want this to be a show for insiders. Insiders being people who write about the theater, people who go to the theater a lot, really a lot. Then isn't it kind of like the Drama Desk Awards or the OCC Awards? And I'm not putting those down. I'm an OCC member. I vote there as well. But
no,
these have a higher aspiration, and they should. And I think the experimenting is good. It doesn't always work. That's what experimentation means. Sometimes you throw something up against a wall, it slides down, it plops on the ground. A lot of stuff here plopped. But I don't think it should just be a show for purists.
When I was watching the Tonys with a bunch of friends, I said, you know what we should do? We should watch the 1960 broadcast after we finished this. And it was immediately embraced. And I wrote about this in my Kritzeland column a couple of weeks ago. And frankly, the 1960 show was a little pokey. I have to leave, I'm sorry to say, because I have to go to Long Branch, New Jersey, and I've got to get there for a 2 o'clock show, and I'm not remotely ready. So please forgive. We will talk very soon, okay?
Well, Jan, I don't know. I think there's a happy medium. I mean, of course, no one wants it to be a totally insular show that only appeals to people who go to Broadway, you know, 35 times a year. But I really, you know, like I said, they have been trying all of this stuff for years, and it seems to not be working. Your point is well taken. I mean, we can never know exactly why the ratings dropped, and I think it is. You're probably right that the fact that there wasn't one huge hit like Book of Mormon certainly had something to do with it. But I don't know. I mean, instead of having Neil Patrick Harris hanging upside down in back of Ted Chapin and Angela Lansbury, I think we could have maybe had the memorial section, you know, instead of that.
They had to read that boilerplate.
Yeah, but... Well, I mean, that's just one example. The cruise ship thing, and we've rehashed that mm-hmm. 1,000 times, so I won't go into that again. But I don't know. I think the in memoriam section has to be included, and something else has to go instead.
I agree.
So, one of the things I want to talk about just for a minute here, because we're actually, you know, well beyond our hour mark that we try to stick to, is that. The most popular shows that are out there, let's say the Academy Awards, let's talk about the Super Bowl. What are the other large, really large events that are out there? You know, the Queen thing that happened last week. What's the...
the Jubilee.
The Jubilee.
The Queen thing, yeah.
Yeah, not the Freddie Mercury thing, the real Queen.
Yeah.
Or is he the real queen?
The real queen.
So you think about the really large events like that. For the month preceding those events, it's all we hear about. Mm. You know, and this is what the Tony Awards don't do, and this is what the Broadway shows don't do well. I mean, I don't talk about this very much on, you know, with outside of the immediate sphere, is that I don't get press tickets. I buy all my own tickets to Broadway shows, and I do that. You know, I'm offered press tickets and free tickets and things like that, and I do it because I really want to see what the experience is without owing anybody anything. I don't want to have to write a review or do anything else. But so, and I also want to see what the experience is for the audience. What is it like to go to Telecharge and Ticketmaster and get your own tickets or go to the box office? And what are the fees like? And how much does it really, how painful is it to buy tickets? So the point is that I buy my own tickets to shows, and I was not marketed to by any of the Tony Award nominating shows that said, they've got my email address, they've got my phone number, my contact information. I've not gotten an email from any of the shows that said, you know, support.
And interestingly enough, James, a friend of mine sent an email about, and I don't get the print edition of the Times, but he said that in today's Times, there's almost no ads about, let me see how he phrased it, let's see if I can find it. Well, anyway, almost no ads about the Tony winners. So I guess, I mean, we know that those ads are very expensive, but they've always been there in the past. I guess people are choosing different ways. But if you're seeing you didn't even get emails, then I don't wonder how they are. Then
you know,
how they.
My point is that. You're going to get your core audience of Broadway insiders and super fans and things like that they know when the Tony Awards are. They write it down on the calendar months in advance, and they start planning. What we need to develop audiences and build the audiences, get the casual fans interested in seeing the Tonys, and not by seeing a 10 or 15 second clip on CBS that runs on off hours that says Tony Awards tonight or something. It's not enough marketing is being done, and the onus can't be just put on the Tony Awards and on CBS. They need to each one of the Broadway shows in the Broadway community and the Broadway League and the American Theater Wing need to market the Tony Awards better. They make a whole lot of money on the Tony Awards, and I think that gravy train is coming to an end. I think that and it's their fault that it's coming to an end, because you look at the Oscars, for instance. You know, every single picture that's out there markets that the Oscars are coming up, as well as the Oscars marketing and the television network that has it and all the other stuff. And the same thing with the Super Bowl. Everybody markets that the Super Bowl is coming up. Doritos markets, the Pepsi's marketing, GoDaddy's marketing that. All these companies are marketing that the Super Bowl is coming up. And meanwhile, the Tony Awards have one marketing arm, and that's CBS just putting out a few clips on their station that they don't really pay for anyway.
Yeah. So you have an excellent point. I mean, when you think about it, yes, of course, the Broadway audience is a tiny fraction of the movie audience, but it's still a lot of people.
Yeah.
I mean, when you think of all of those people who come to New York from wherever, or whether they live here or whether they come here from somewhere else, to see all of those shows 8 times a week, that should translate into decent ratings, shouldn't it?
If you can convert the Tony Awards into the strategy for a Tony Awards into being the strategy for running for president of the United States, where you break it down into, 50 states and smaller markets within each state. And every single state, I'm going to go out on a limb here and assume something, every single state in the United States has, some sort of major regional theater in it. And it also has lots of community theaters, and there's a network of grassroots built in here, where all the Tony Awards needs to do is start coordinating a few months ahead of time and say, we have state coordinators, we have local coordinators, we have community coordinators, we're setting up all different things. Instead, they do a half-assed effort all the time to get people in there and say, oh, we tried to do this. Oh, we put up a PDF to how to throw a Tony Awards party. Please. Folks,
it's an interesting idea. It's an interesting idea. I think probably the community has looked more at the show as being the promotional tool for the Broadway community, as opposed to using it in another way. And I think you raise an interesting.
Jan,
idea.
I want to tell you that I have two different examples to share with you. I have been part of companies that have built amazing, amazing websites, like possibly, one of the best 100 websites on the internet. And they can't get anybody to, they don't focus on getting anybody to the website. So it exists, in an isolation, and nobody ever appreciates it. I've been part of teams that have produced recordings of Broadway shows and various artists, and they think that once the recording is done, that their job is done. And I'm like, once the recording is done, the job is one third done. Now you need to go out and promote it and let people know that it's out there.
Yeah.
And I feel that's the same way about the Tonys. Is like, we got to do something. The Broadway shows, they're going to have returns tenfold over if they can get people to watch the Tony Awards so they can see their, somewhat of a commercial for their show.
Well, I don't know what they are doing, but I guess it's a slightly different subject, but I found my friend's email. I want to read it. He says, the Sunday after the Tony Awards and not a single full or half page ad in the Times Arts and Leisure section boasting of Tony wins. The biggest ad wrapping around the ABCs is Clybourne Park. No display ads at all for once, Newsies, Porgy and Bess, or Peter and the Starcatcher. And his conclusion is no need to purchase the print edition of the Times anymore.
Well, Michael, what is in the full page ad in print edition of the New York Times?
What?
Rock of Ages, the movie. And, you know, I joke about that, but I'm serious.
Which apparently is doing horribly at the box office.
But if you drive around New York in the tri-state area, there are billboards everywhere for Rock of Ages.
Yeah.
And they're promoting it, and they will make their money back and then some profit. Even though it's doing terribly, they have a model to get this out there. And whether or not it's good or not, it's irrelevant because the money's been spent, but now they need people to see it. So there's nothing that, you know, a movie, you can't fix a movie. Once it's done, it's done, you know. It's not like, let's go rewrite the second act. We're in previews. You know, they're going to market the hell out of Rock of Ages, and they'll make their money. They will. So, yeah. And then one of the last things we want to talk about today is Sutton Foster is a bunhead. And I say that in the most endearing way.
Yeah.
So, Jan, why don't you talk about Bunheads for a little bit?
Bunheads is a new television series that Sutton Foster is starring in. It started this week. It's on the ABC Family Network, I believe. And she plays a dancer, surprise, who is working as a Vegas showgirl and has a crazy night where she gets drunk and wakes up and finds out that she has married this guy who's been pursuing her, sort of a stage door Johnny, I guess. And he moves her to his hometown, which is one of those quirky hometowns that only seem to be on TV, where everybody knows everyone and everybody's eccentric. And his mother is runs a dance school there, and those are the bunheads, the little girls who are ballerinas and wear their hair up in a bun. And it is going to it seems as though it's going to be a buddy show between Sutton and the mother, who I believe is played by Kelly Bishop. And I wish I felt that it were a better show than it is. It's not fair, really, to judge a show by the pilot, by the first episode. And so maybe I will dip in again. Sutton Foster is just her always endearing self. You want to root for the show and you want to see it because she is just terrific, and she really is. But the show itself, I'm not yet convinced. I don't know. Did you see it, Michael?
No, I haven't seen it yet, but I've heard good things.
Yeah, I haven't seen it, but I have a link to it in the show notes so that you can actually watch the first episode or two online.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to broaderradio.com, there's a link to the official ABC Family YouTube section where they have Bunheads, and you can watch a bunch of it there. So, Jan, are we thinking that it's possible we've lost Sutton Foster to Hollywood, or is it just a brief stay?
Well, I think it might be a brief stay. I don't.
No, you know, I keep fearing that we're going to lose Kristen Chenoweth, and she keeps on hooking up with shows that are not quite
not
making it.
Yes.
You know, I mean, people who love musicals and should just see. I mean, you've got Sutton Foster on the one hand, and you've got Kelly Bishop, who was the original Sheila in A Chorus Line, on the other hand. So these are, you know, our folk. So people should tune in and watch it. Maybe it'll be like Smash. Maybe it'll sort of limp through and there'll be enough of an audience that they'll really put some firepower into it. Although I should say that the creator of this show is the woman who created The Gilmore Girls, which is a very popular show on Fox for many years. And it's a very personal show for her because she started out as a dancer. And so maybe once we've gotten all the exposition out of the way, which happened this week, and there's a dramatic something that happens that I'm not going to say because everybody should click on James's link and watch it, And maybe after it settles down and really establishes its routine, it'll be better than this first episode was.
All right. So in wrapping up, let's quickly talk about 54 Below. The lines for Patti LuPone are out the door. Do we think that this is going to be a new hot spot for Broadway performers to 54 Below as a new, would you call it nightclub, that's below Studio 54, the famed nightclub, which is now a roundabout theater company property where they have shows, eight shows a week.
I was wondering if somebody else brought up too, since it's in the basement of what used to be Studio 54, God only knows what used to go on in
it. I think a lot of us know.
You think Stritch can tell us?
I don't know. Maybe we could ask Liza or who else? Anyway. Well, I will say that they have an amazing lineup already. Yeah. If you know, I was just looking at it the other day, and I think they're booked at least through September, October, and they have some great, great people. So, and it is nice to have another option for that kind of thing, and they also seem to be focusing much more on Broadway people. It is billed as, I believe, as Broadway's nightclub. So to see those people in that context, you know, you didn't have much other option other than Feinstein's, or you know, which is very, very high end. I think this is a little less expensive, at least for some people.
A little less.
Yeah, and I also noticed that it apparently tickets vary from person to person, which maybe is not so surprising. Patty is more expensive than some other people who are coming up. But yeah, you know, and there's Joe's Pub, which is great, but it's not in the theater district, and they have a lot of different types of acts. So it'll be interesting to see. I want to see the space also, especially. It's apparently quite lovely and intimate, so I want to try to get there soon.
I don't know. On the West Coast, Barbra Streisand's opening up her house to have fundraisers. So it's $50,000 a person to walk in the door, so it's a little bit more expensive than 54 Below. All right, and finally, last thing we're going to talk about is that Monday night is the 50th anniversary of Shakespeare in the Park, and there's going to be a benefit performance of Romeo and Juliet. And who are our young star-crossed lovers, Michael?
They are Meryl Streep and Kevin Kline.
Those young whippersnappers. There they are.
We can't review it yet because it hasn't opened, but I do want to just say I had a magical experience at As You Like It in the park the other night, because it was one of those, I mean, it usually rains when I try to go see Shakespeare in the park, but it did not. It was a gorgeous night, and it's a wonderful production, and there's just nothing like that place. And it would be cool to be there on the actual night of the 50th anniversary, which is the night of this Romeo and Juliet, but I didn't even bother to ask for a press ticket because
I'm not sure there are press tickets. Start at $1,500.
Yeah, that's what I meant. And it sounds like it might be really, really, really worth it, but I just couldn't.
Well, it sounds wonderful because it's got just everybody that you'd ever want to see. getting together in this. I mean, I think, Christine Baranski and Jeffrey Wright.
Yes.
And, I think Raul Esparza, Jerry Stiller. They're all taking minor characters. It's obviously a high-end reading, but all people who got their starts or at least worked early on at the Public, and our John Cullum. I'm looking. F. Murray Abraham is playing Friar Lawrence. Bill Irwin. I mean, every time I look and see Felicia Rashad, it's just a Sam Waterston. Oh, good Lord. It's a really, really great a group of people coming together to celebrate a really, really great organization. The Public is the one place that still, when I go, it has the most diverse audience in the city. in just every way, age-wise, race-wise, it's gay, straight. It's just, I love going down there and just being in that lobby and watching people go to their various shows. And it really reflects Joe Papp's original ethos of wanting it to be there to be theater for the people of the city of New York. And it's just amazing that it's 50 years old and it should be celebrated.
And by the way, I mentioned I was just there for February House, and although they still, it looks like they still have a long, fairly long way to go with the renovation down there, the front of the theater is almost finished, and
yeah.
They have a wonderful new step set up to bring you into the theater, and then they also have I guess what do you call those things like poster, like they have outside the Met, those lighted stands that they put posters in and things
yeah.
like that.
And they're going to have it's going to be called the library. They're going to have a restaurant there as well.
Oh, right. Yes. Yes.
It's going to be.
And Joe's Pub has been beautifully mm-hmm. renovated. So yeah, very exciting. Very, very exciting for the public.
All right, so I guess we should wrap it up here. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com, and there's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded for you. I just heard from a bunch of sources that it's really important for us to have a lot of people listen to us directly off of the website or through Stitcher or something like that. Even if you do that, just go into iTunes and click subscribe. You don't have to listen to it there, but a high number of subscribe numbers will get us promoted by Apple, which is really important to growing the audience for This Week on Broadway. Also, there is the Broadway Radio Survey, which is on the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. It will help us understand our audience a little bit better, and we've gotten a lot of great feedback from that so far. If you want to contact anybody here, go to Broadway Radio. Our show notes are there. That we will have links, as I mentioned, to stories that we've talked about, plus some of the videos that we had for this week, and contact information for Peter, Michael, myself, link to Jan's website, and also, you know, all the other stuff, our voicemail, phone number, our Twitter, Facebook accounts, things like that. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio, Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. We appreciate Broadway World for rebroadcasting us to their audience as well there. And that's about it. Jan, Michael, anything that you want to add right now to wrap up the day?
No, no. Not me, Michael.
Well, not to end on a negative note, but I see that Audra McDonald has missed at least one more performance of Porgy and Bess, thereby sending the producers into, I'm sure, a tailspin, because there are apparently tremendous amounts of returns when she doesn't show up. So that's unfortunate. As I think I mentioned a while ago, she apparently had asked for there to be an alternate,
yeah,
and that was not granted for, I guess, reasons that are obvious. But you know, I mean, it's unfortunate because when she feels she can't go on for whatever reason, there's going to be lots of tremendously disappointed people. So I think that's unfortunate for them. But on the other hand, I'm so negative on that production and actually the performance also that that I guess I'm not as upset as fans would be, but that. But that is just a situation that exists, and it's something to consider when a star is one of the really major reasons that a show is produced, because people are human and they can't be there all the time.
All right. So on behalf of Michael Portantier, Peter Felicia, and Jam Simpson, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
How can I be any use to you now? Give me a chance and I'll let you see how nothing has changed. Deep in my heart I'm concealing things that I'm longing to say. Scared to confess what I'm feeling. Frightened you'll slip away. You must love me. just love.